If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Ruler podcast with me, Jack Thurston. This is the podcast for issue 48 of the magazine. And here with me, along with a pneumatic drill, is ex-professional bike racer Tom Southern, contributor to the magazine, and making your third appearance on the Ruler podcast. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you. I might add that it's not me with the pneumatic drill, actually, but thank you.
You're a committed absinthe drinker. This is something that we've learned about you on social media. I guess pneumatic drills and absinthe and the morning don't go too well together.
Any time after I start drinking absinthe, a pneumatic drill wouldn't go down well at all, so I try and avoid them. But I don't normally start until the evening. I'm not committed enough to start in the morning yet. So.
Well, I guess if you started in the evening and carried on and then got the wake-up call from the pneumatic drill, that's going to be ugly.
I've carried on a few times and it doesn't go well. It doesn't go with or without a drill. It doesn't go well. So.
Well, I don't think there's any absinthe in the current issue of the magazine, but let's dive in with our opening choices of favourite photos or photo spreads from this issue.
Yeah, so mine's actually going to be one of Andy Waterman's pictures from the piece I did on Dave Rayner. A double page spread of his training diary from when he was, I'm not quite sure of the year, it's just got January. When we went there and when we sort of met the family and they got out a lot of photos in his old training diaries, it almost felt like we were getting such an intimate portrait of the guy. It almost felt it was quite intimate, and I found it fascinating that they were so keen for us to sort of look into these and to photograph them and let Andy take pictures for the magazine. And I mean, I like training diaries anyway, but this is a lovely thing. He's kept a record of his mileage, of where he went, and he splits each of his days into morning, afternoon and evening, and he's got like what he does in them, and some of them are wonderful. In the afternoon, one afternoon he's got washed car, one afternoon he's got messed around, went looking for vitamins, or half an hour on the turbo, and little things like that. And it's just a lovely little glimpse into someone's life as a cyclist.
My choice is at the other end of the magazine, and it's a portrait of Roger de Vlaeminck in a series of black and white portraits of cyclists of days gone by. And I think it's just a lovely photograph. I mean, he is a very charismatic man in every sense, in the way he looks, in the way he talks, in the way he rides, or the way he rode. And here he looks like a gangster, doesn't he? Basically,
he looks fantastic in this picture. There's something about him, and it's quite interesting knowing how he's how he's acted in his old age. Like there are people that might suggest he hasn't quite grown old gracefully. Certainly when Tom Boonen won 4 Paris-Roubaix, and he came out and said, "Well, it's not as hard as when I did it." And he still has a lot of attitude about him in this photo, and. Yeah, he sort of oozes that, like you said, like a gangster, that kind of badass attitude, which I guess is what he had on the bike as well.
Okay, well let's start with your piece that you just mentioned there about Dave Rayner. Now, tell us who Dave Rayner was.
Dave Rayner was a former professional cyclist, one of the few at the time in the UK who actually managed to make it as a European pro. So I think there was much more of a division, certainly in the 80s and 90s, between a domestic rider and a European professional. Europe was still very much years and years ahead in terms of the cycling world. It was much further away as well, so the idea of going across there when you're young with no internet, no access to call home, and making a life out there was a much, much bigger task. And he was one of the guys who did it. He went out and he rode for Buckler, which was one of the biggest teams of the time, if not the. Spent a few years there. I had an interesting career, which was, you know, tragically cut short when he was killed in a nightclub at just age 27, which is a horrible, horrible story, and one that was quite hard to tell when you have, you know, someone who's a loss of life like that. So it was a challenging story to tell. It's one of those things you really want to do justice to, and I hope that we did, really.
Oh, well, I think you definitely did. His name lives on in the name of a fund set up to help young riders. What was the impetus for the family to set up that fund? I mean, it's something that a lot of people who suffer this kind of tragedy, they do feel they want to create something to allow something of the person that they've lost to continue on into the future.
Yeah, I think when we went up there and we sort of sat around, obviously when we were there, Keith Lambert and Sid Barris and his wife Linda, who are from the fund, came over as well on the same day and talked to us. And as soon as I got there, I noticed the sense of community that's built around cycling that exists there. And it's so incredibly strong that I think when I spoke to Sid Barris about it, he almost said it was a foregone conclusion, because it's something that has brought the Rayner family right into the heart of that community. It was an important thing for, I think, everyone to do, because I think the whole community was hit by the shock of it. And so I think it may have been born out of grief, just out of some sort of let's keep this name going. But since, it's quite nice to see, like, talking to John Rayner, he has riders all over the world who know about the Rayner Fund, and he sort of gets on the internet and follows these guys, and it's given the family almost a whole other sort of family to follow. Which is a really, really lovely thing, and I think it's only managed to exist for so long because it does exist for the right reasons. And it's actually got really interesting when you meet guys who were born after Rayner, you know, had died, so who could never have known him, but then his name is still going to be important in their careers. And in the best and sort of grandest sense, his name does live on in that way, which I think is the real idea behind the fund, to support the Rayner family through the community.
So who funds it? Where does the money come from?
It's all run on donations, basically. So they have the Rayner Fund dinner at the end of every year when they raise money there. They have quite a lot of private donators. And basically, they started off just going around with buckets at events and asking for money. And I think in the first few years, they would have had a few £1,000. I mean, I spoke to Charlie Vigelius, who was one of the first intake, I think, along with David Miller. And basically, yeah, I think Charlie got £2,000 for the year or something, he said, but that was all they had. And these days, they've got 20 riders on it, I think, and a much bigger turnover. So it's got... They also run a sportive as well, which obviously generates a lot of income, but all of these things rely on the goodwill of the volunteers who help run it, which is, yeah.
How necessary is a fund like that now compared to the days when Dave Rayner himself was trying to make it as a professional bike racer? You describe Charlie Vigelius at £2,000 being a huge amount of money that actually made something possible. You spoke to Theo Gegenhardt, and he said that, well, it's not really about the money because I'm very well looked after on my development team. Is that a sign of how much things have changed for young riders in Britain today?
Yes, and also for the fund, I think, because the interesting thing about when I spoke to Theo was his point was, like, the money is a help, but the biggest help is the name of the fund itself, because the fund's grown so much in 20 years that it's now almost a calling card for a guy like Theo. So when he did run into Dave Miller in Girona, he was like, oh, look, I'm on the Dave Rayner fund straight away. And then Miller knew, okay, he's doing this. And it's become sort of the alternative to the sort of GB system, one of the alternatives to the GB system, which... The GB system then is the argument that things have really, really changed, because there are other riders going through that who obviously have things that, you know, riders like Dave Rayner couldn't have dreamed of. The direct link into a professional team, which then now exists at Team Sky, and also the change of perceptions of British riders in the European peloton is a massive thing. Before, previously, getting into a team, you were like a second-rate citizen. So why would we take you? You don't have good guys. But then when you've got guys at the top like Cavendish and Wiggins who are winning, then it's like, well, hang on, these British guys might have something. It's changed. It's unrecognisable compared to what it was.
Is there any downside to the infusion of money and support that's come to riders? Because you allude to the fact that in Dave Rayner's career, short as it was, he learnt the old ways, you know, hard riding as a young man trying to keep up with riders that were much his senior in terms of age and condition. And then obviously going to the continent with very little teaches you a certain amount of self-reliance and toughness. Do you think that there's any downside? I'm not saying that these guys are cosseted and pampered, but do you think that there's something that the system can't introduce, which is a sort of toughness and a self-reliance? Or do you think that just naturally comes from the rigours of bike racing?
I think in some respects cycling's just hard enough. There is a part of you that thinks, you know, you need to be tough and learn it this way and that way, but actually that's kind of bollocks, because, you know, if you get there and you're good enough, why make your life harder? It's so hard. And I think for years the major advantage that, say, an Italian rider would have over an English rider was the fact that they weren't going through absolute purgatory on their own, lost in an apartment. They've always been at home, they've always been looked after, they've always been close to their family. So the fact that guys can have it now and don't have to do it, I think, is probably a good thing, really, you know. There's no need to sort of brandish yourself with that stamp of genuineness or whatever it was that we all thought there, you know, we all thought there was, but it's just changed.
One of the riders that you spoke to who was a beneficiary of the Rayner Fund was Jonathan Tin and Locke, and you are a friend of Jonathan's, and Jonathan has now been given a 2-year sanction by the UCI, confirmed by the UK Anti-Doping Agency. I mean, you, the very earliest stages of when this situation was announced, you put your head above the parapet on Jonathan's behalf. What are your thoughts now?
Not a lot's really changed in my mind. I believed in John from the start. He's a close friend of mine. That's not changed. He's obviously chosen not to speak to the press, so I can't speak on his part, nor do I want to say that I am. I imagine he's pretty disappointed at the moment with what's happened. It's pretty sad for the guy, whatever the case. I certainly still believe in him. I just don't think that I don't think it adds up what he was accused of doing and how he could have done it in Plymouth in the UK, and how he would have had the network of support to do that. Certainly not when he was racing alongside me at the team that I was in and earning the kind of money you earn in the UK. I don't know how you could even comprehend financing a sophisticated doping regime on, you know, sort of £12,000-£10,000 a year that guys are earning in small UK teams. He's obviously put all this to a committee, and they've said what they've said. So I think he'll walk away from the sport and get on with his life and do something else. And you have to remember that there's a lot more to life than bike riding. So as long as he is a happy and comfortable individual in his life, then you've got nothing to worry about, really.
The case does raise some questions in relation to transparency of the process of this biological passport, because that's what was flagged up. It was some anomalies in the biological passport, and that, to you know, that doesn't really mean anything, does it? I mean, it's sort of reading between the lines, it means blood doping, but it's not very clear compared to a traditional positive test, yeah, where you can have the lab results, you can put the spectrometer, what do they call it, the spectrograms on the internet, and you can see, you know, here is the synthetic testosterone, or here is whatever, here is the clenbuterol, how did that get into your system? Biological passport anomalies, it doesn't really say very much, and there does seem to be a problem here in terms of justice being seen to be done, that there needs to be more explanation on the part of the people who are taking someone's livelihood away from them.
And I think if you rewind sort of 10 years, whatever it was, and in Charlie's book, we wrote about when Charlie went above the hematocrit line, when the test was still a crude indicator of who was taking EPO and who wasn't. And Charlie basically went to clear himself, it's in the book, he went to clear himself, went to the lab and said to the doctors, like, this is kind of bullshit, this is natural. And they said, yeah, we know there's going to be anomalies, but this is the best system that we have at the moment, and there's going to be casualties, and I'm sorry about that. And when you're the individual concerned, you don't want to be noble and think, oh well, you just take my livelihood, you've worked your entire life off for it, you know. So it's very hard to stomach. And from one side of the argument, you think, well, okay, there's going to be collateral damage, but it's cleaning the sport up, which is fantastic, and it's what we really need. On the other side of the argument, there is the individual who loses something, and it does happen, I think, who loses something unfairly. Nothing's ever going to be perfect in that sense. I'm sure it's much, much better, but if I was an athlete now, and I was on the blood, you know, on the blood passport, and I thought there was even the slightest chance of it not working and being wrong, then I'd really be shitting myself. Because let's say John Tynan Lock goes down for something he didn't do, surely every other athlete in the world should think, hang on a minute, that could be me. But most athletes' attitude, again, is just to get on with their own stuff. You don't want to worry about other people. So it's much, much easier to go, okay, well, sure, maybe he was doing something. And in anyone's case, it's much, much easier just to look at it and go, oh, well, I'm sure he was doing something. And I'd be as guilty as anyone if I saw a rider I didn't know in a continental team pop up and start, you know, smashing people apart. Then you'd ask questions. I remember a few years ago, a guy called Petcha Roman, who rode for a tiny little Spanish team, won 3 or 4 stage races in a year. Like, rode Bettini off the wheel to win one of them. He was outstanding. Went to Quickstep and was a disaster for years. And I always just went, oh, well, just labelled him as, you know, flash in the pan, who had done something to get where he was. I don't know his story. I don't know whether he was doping, whether he wasn't doping, or... Even before John had a problem, I remember thinking about Petcha Roman. I remember thinking, shit, I'd judge that guy so quickly, and yet I wouldn't judge my friend in the same way. So I don't know if it's a good example or a bad example.
I guess one thing we can certainly agree on is that explaining a bit more about how the biological passport works and what the anomalies are would be a good idea, because there are informed journalists out there, there are very informed fans out there who can, you know, interpret these things with a degree of sophistication, and the UCI just updating a PDF document on its website and not providing any kind of supporting evidence is just not really up to the standards of transparency that were the platform of Brian Cookson's campaign to replace Pat McQuaid.
Yeah, I mean, I agree, but I also have to admit that I'm not someone who's informed. Like, I couldn't read into it, and I don't know. I've never taken a great interest in that side of things, and I respect the journalists who do. I think they've got, you know, there is a place for them, and they do all the right things, and it's fantastic. But and they should be asking those questions. I'm not informed enough to know either way. So
let's look at some postcards from the Giro. This is a really nice feature. Opens up with an email from Andy McGrath to Chris Ulle Jensen. Is that how you pronounce his name?
I've got no idea.
It's Danish, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Danish rider, making, I think, his debut in the Giro. And Andy says, "Dear Chris, we're thinking of doing a cool feature in the next edition of Rouleur. After every stage of the Giro d'Italia, you write the stage number, the date, and some words on a postcard and send it to us." And that's pretty much how it works out. So it starts off with postcards. It's quite good at the beginning. Then obviously the postcard availability diminishes. It seems like it gets quite a good few postcards in Northern Ireland and Ireland, and then it sort of turns into race numbers and so what's this, food wrappers.
Yeah. From there's the a bit of food wrapper there, and then I think there's a track mitt somewhere. There's room lists. It's quite an eclectic. Quite an eclectic mix, a lot of rider numbers, his and other people's.
Which a little profile there, sort of annotated.
Yeah, it's
with a nice. I love this one on this. This is stage 8, with a great big blue arrow saying, I got dropped about here.
Yeah, right at the foot of the climb. No, that's it's nice. It's a charming little collection of stuff, and it's good on him for doing it, because I think doing anything like that during a doing something as stressful and hard as a Grand Tour is remarkable, really. There's a cap there, which is quite nice, full of road dirt.
What's the longest stage race you've ridden?
I think 12 days, I think, would have been the longest I did. A week to 12 days is kind of all the same, really. There's not like a great big difference, and there's a lot of week-long, 8, 9, 10 days like stage races. When you get to a Grand Tour, something I never did, I imagine it just gets beyond that. When you've still got 8, 9 sort of days to go, that gets when it gets really, really hard.
I mean, we both got the sense reading the piece that from about stage 14 to sort of stage 17 is where he really starts falling apart mentally a little bit and going a bit off the rails. I mean, in a very charming kind of way.
Yeah, there's one, I can't remember where it is, where it gets quite dark and he's just like, I'm really sorry, my mind, that's it, mind is slowing down, can't comprehend any big decisions, have no more toothpaste, nor does Jay. What do we do? And that's all he can get out of it. It's like, that is stage 13, and it's kind of... When I've done interviews with guys on Grand Tours, I remember I went to meet Dave Miller a few years ago at the Tour de France, and it was quite far in. And Dave's a guy who's constantly full of energy, he's permanently hyperactive almost. And I met him, and he was just really, like, it was like he was considering every word that he said, because he was just in utter survival mode. And so it really hit me, like, geez, these guys are exhausted, which is, yeah, amazing, really.
When we spoke at the summit finish on Dartmoor last year at the Tour of Britain, you talked, I thought, very interestingly about the rhythm of a day's racing in the Tour of Britain and how races develop their rhythm and settle into a pattern and that kind of thing. And there's a rhythm to a Grand Tour or a stage race, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you do kind of fall into that quite easily, that rhythm, when you're sort of focused on the small things ahead. So it's like, okay, well, where might I be getting dropped, like where am I going to ride in the groupetto to, so then like working things out, the way you know what you're going to have for breakfast, knowing what time you get up, and all those things just sort of fall into place. And it's quite, people often turn, but you're living inside a bubble, which is quite interesting. When I spoke to Dave Miller as well, I asked him about that, and he just said, well, we always live inside a bubble as bike riders. We're always protected by what we do, and we're always in a rhythm of doing things every day, getting up to go training. I mean, you know, you go training around 9 o'clock every day or 10 o'clock every day, and then you train until this time and you rest until this time. So I think your life sort of leads you into that as a cyclist, whereas outside that, your life's a little bit more unpredictable.
Well, this brings us quite neatly, I think, to Morten Okpo's piece, which is ostensibly about a hotel in Belgium, right? Or is
yes.
it in
yeah, Belgium? Yeah.
It's
yep.
a Belgian hotel, legendary hotel. The Hotel Malpertus, a legendary hotel in cycle sport. But Morten and photographer Jakob Christian Sorensen are not going there to learn about the hotel and its place in cycle sport. And they find it quite difficult not to get all those stories.
Well, I think they kind of went there because they did want to get that. But then I think Morten is one of those... He's a great writer, and he sees something that's interesting and he wants to get onto it. And I think he sort of noticed Valeria Piva, who is the hotel owner, his wife, and he sort of thought, she's more interesting, she's got a story to tell. And his article is actually about trying to get the story out of her, because every time he talks to her, she just defers to, well, my husband did this, or my husband did that, or this. He's like, yeah, but what about you? It turns out she's like her father was a cyclist, so she's from a very traditional cycling background, and basically she was told, right, you're going to marry a cyclist and you have to look after him and you have to, you know, be a good cycling wife. And that's what she's built up her life to do, which is in itself fascinating, because she's sort of given up everything. It seems like she almost lives through him. I think Morten's kind of trying to... It's really interesting reading. He's trying to shake her out of herself. And I think he says he shouts at her at one stage, which is... Yeah, must be quite interesting.
I mean, it's always difficult talking about Morten's pieces, because you really do need... You need to really just read them and draw your own conclusions. It's an interesting piece. It's quite starts from quite a difficult premise, I think, for a modern enlightened reader, and Morton alludes to that there is this life of the bike racing partner, widow, you might say, who you know, for hundreds of days a year they're not there, and then when they are there, you know, everything's got to be done for them. I mean, it's quite difficult to switch from that role of independence and self-reliance to, you know, near subservience.
Absolutely, it must be a very strange thing to have someone, for kids as well, who's not there all the time and then suddenly turns up. And I think it's interestingly, it's something that a lot of riders sort of struggle with when they do finish their career, because all of a sudden you get these two people that have spent half their lives apart, and it's like, oh, actually, we have to live under the same roof every day. And then, yeah, if you go to any Grand Tour and you'll notice all the bike riders sort of slipping back into old habits, and then, you know, working as drivers or doing this or doing that, and it's just because they're so used to it. The only way to sort of keep home life working is to not be there. Was it somebody told me once, the only way to stay married for 25 years is to not be there for half of them? So,
did you notice a difference in the demeanour of riders who had a family life back home, a wife, children perhaps, and those who were yet to start a family? I mean, they talk about the curse of Bambino, don't they? You know, as soon as you have a child, the results disappear.
I think it's natural. There's another thing that came up when talking to Charlie a lot is, you know, there are riders who have a newborn and he's like, okay, well, I'm going to sleep in a different room and I'm not going to do anything about this kid when it cries in the night, because I need to be informed, I need to get my rest. For the mother to take all that on and just accept it, it must be very tough. I think the biggest difference is, well, it isn't between those who have a family and those who don't, it's between those riders who spend their time chasing women on races and those who don't. And there's a lot of energy wasted that way, I'm sure.
Have you moved on from being a professional bike racer? You're wearing a pair of shorts here, and I can see your hirsute in the leg department.
Yeah, I think so. I like to think so. I mean, it's quite hard because I still work very much in the sport, and sometimes I feel like I haven't actually got that far. So I'm sure I will in time. I don't feel like a bike rider anymore. Certainly not when I ride my bike, that's for sure.
Anything else in the issue catch your eye, Tom? We've got the feature on Hannah Barnes.
Yeah, I was actually reading that, and there was not only do I know Hannah and Rachel, he or her DS, who're both lovely. I read a lovely bit about how the United Healthcare men and women travel to races together, and all as one sort of team, which I found sort of really great. As a rider, I would have absolutely loved that, just because a cycling team is a very masculine sort of environment, and you can, in a long time together of all blokes, you can get a bit sort of bored of each other and fed up. So it must be a really interesting place to be, to have sort of, you know, men and women all together, and yeah, seems quite forward thinking.
Yeah, there's a lot of forward thinking stuff. It's quite a optimistic article about the future of women's cycling there, because it focuses a bit about the Women's Tour of Britain, which, you know, does seem to have set a new high bar in terms of a women's stage race.
Yeah, I mean, that went down fantastically, and I think it sort of opened everyone's eyes, and, you know, hopefully it continues to grow.
You can also read about light speed bicycles, both titanium and carbon, in a feature by Ian Cleverly, and the usual columns by Johnny Green, Robert Miller, an optimistic one from Robert Miller, and I must ask you about Matt Seaton's column, Pronus, where he describes being out on a sort of ride, riding around doing laps of Central Park, where a guy in full Belkin kit kind of sits in, and everyone's like, oh God, who's this twat in the full team kit? And it turns out that it's Robert Hasink, who actually does ride for the team, who's had some sort of injury and is in New York with his family and just getting a spin in.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lovely piece, because I think it's one of, as he says in it, one of the great things about cycling, which I enjoy both as a rider, as a pro, and as a punter almost, is the fact that you can share the road. You know, you can never go and play cricket with Shane Warne, or, you know, kick a football around with, you know, whoever, but you can just ride with someone. And most, you know, pro bike riders were all bike riders at one stage. As long as you don't knock them off or dick around, then they really enjoy just being a bike rider sometimes, which is really nice.
Thank you very much, Tom Southam, for chatting about issue 48 of the magazine. And just to play out on this issue, a couple of weeks ago I was covering the National Road Race Championships for the Ruler Annual, which will be coming out towards the end of the year. And as is always the way with writers for Ruler, my job on the day was essentially to ferry around the photographer Olaf, who'd flown in from Munich to photograph the event. And as I was driving around, I thought I'd just keep a little bit of an audio record of what had happened. And so here's me and Olaf at the National Road Race Championships. Olaf, this is your first time in Wales, right?
That's right, yeah. First time South Wales.
And we've driven out to a kind of hillside we recce'd last night in the fading light to find Olaf a place to take a photograph. This is just for one photograph we've driven out here, isn't it?
Yeah, it's always like we try to do a shoot where you can a little bit recognize where you are, because usually the cycling circus is a global thing, so the same riders, the same shirts everywhere, and now we are doing the British Nationals. That's why I thought we should find a spot where we can recognize Wales.
And maybe we can describe the scene. We're just in a little lay-by here. Yesterday night there was a large agricultural transport vehicle used for moving large quantities of sheep around. That has just pulled away now. So was that a prop? Was that a kind of a thing that you thought you might make use of in a photograph, this large agricultural vehicle?
To be honest, yes. I thought it would be good to have it in or as an alternative shot. But I'm long enough a photographer that I know that take your chance when it is your chance and not a day later or 2 seconds later.
And we're watching a number of amateur riders or just recreational riders riding up along this road. This is a popular road. This is a road that goes from Abergavenny to Skenfrith and on to Monmouth, and it's a popular road for club riders and recreational riders of all kinds. And it's amazing, having just been down at the signing on for the men's race, to see the difference. You really feel that the people we're seeing going past, they just look like ordinary people, but they look like a kind of different species to the guys who are racing when you see them close up.
In general, it's like a different species, the professionals and the amateurs and the amateurs and the hobby riders and always down the ladder. But that's one of the interesting things of the nationals in general, is that they are coming together, the different level of pro riders, and that makes this kind of races such special and such interesting for me and for all of us, because some good riders or really good riders have to go alone if they are the only one, only British one in the team. So they have to link somewhere in a team in this race. So that's interesting in the nationals.
I think we've still got about 20 minutes. We could waffle on, I'm sure, for a long time, but we'll catch up with our progress maybe after Olaf, you've taken your photograph.
Okay, see you later.
We've joined a kind of unofficial caravan publicitaire, except Olaf, you forgot to bring the Haribos to throw out the window. So let's describe the state of the race. We saw a leading group of maybe eight riders, do you think?
Yeah, about eight
or
riders,
10.
And three of them were of Team Sky.
Was it three or four? Three?
Yes.
Okay. I saw a green edge, flash of green edge. So yeah. That would be the Yates brothers, yeah. One of them, or both. And then a lonely figure of Geraint Thomas was coming through, really stuck between this leading pack, maybe 2 minutes or 3 minutes after, and then the next group. Did you get your photo?
We'll see. I'm working on film, and after the lap, I can tell you more. No, I have a good feeling. If I usually, if I don't have the feeling that I get the photo, I'm staying and do it at another time. But in a road race, it's not so easy because you have this moment where you have to get it.
Well, we've just stepped out of the pub. We've been having a little drink at the end of the day. It's been quite a long day, quite an interesting day. And it's just almost as if the National Road Race Championships never happened in this town, because it's all disappeared. Everything's been packed away and driven away on a lorry somewhere, but we're still here. The last time we spoke on the podcast, I was about to deliver you to a bridge on a dual carriageway over the race, and I did manage to leave you there. I felt a bit bad as I looked in my rear view mirror to see you standing there with your rucksack and your Hasselblad dangling from your neck, running along trying to find a spot to photograph. But did you find that spot?
No, everything was fine. It was a good spot, and I did it, and it was like maybe like two or three laps I watched from this point, and I could see that the sky train, how like they called it, and Sky ever had everything in his hand, so there was like no way that another rider, I mean the Oregon Green Edge rider, tried.
Well, Simon Yates, he did well,
and he was the strongest, I think, but without team. He it's a bronze, so it's a third place. It's a great thing he did.
And I think it was also a big surprise for a lot of people, because they would have thought that in a head-to-head between Peter Kenyuk and Ben Swift as the sprinter would take it. But I gather he was cramping a lot during the last circuits, and didn't have the legs in the end. And Peter Kenyuk, in the interview I did with him, with the press corps afterwards, you know, just said he really, really, really wanted to win today. Mm. He really wanted to win.
I knew, you know, I would have done anything for that, to win that race. But I think it was more the tactical advantage and the experience I had from 2009. It is a really difficult sprint, that, to time right and get right. And you can come from behind with a lot of speed. Like, don't forget, I sat on Swifty for maybe the last 5K. He had to, you know, wind the sprint up all the time. I'm saving 50% of my energy, and you know, a better man I wouldn't have betted on myself, but you know, here we go.
Well, Olaf, it's been a pleasure to be on this assignment with you. I hope you've enjoyed listening to our capers as we've caroused around Monmouthshire, but it's been a great pleasure.
Yeah, it was a pleasure for me, and great to be here in Wales.
Thanks for downloading this edition of the Ruler podcast. You can read Ruler magazine, which comes out 8 times a year, by taking out a subscription. Go to www.ruler.cc, or you can pick up the latest edition at a growing number of bookshops and bike shops. If you've got an iPad, you can read the magazine on the iPad. Not only the current issue, but a handful of back issues as well. You'll find it in the Apple Bookstore.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.